Did you change locations? Are you somewhere else today?
I am, well, I'm going to be moving my office down here at some point
Nice.
in the basement, but this is kind of like, well, as you know, I had to vacate the guest room.
That's right. That is
So
true.
that's where my office typically is. So I had to vacate the guest room, and in preparation, I'm like, well, I'll give it a shot down here in the basement today. Hopefully it sounds okay.
Sounds good to me. Randall, why don't we start with a question I didn't prepare you for because I was just thinking about it. When I say to you, tennis superstar, who's the first name that comes to your mind?
Serena Williams.
A great answer. And I think that's a smart answer because I was thinking to myself, this might be a generational question because even though he's not very good, in my mind, it's still Andre Agassi. Like the first person I think of when I think of a tennis player is
Okay.
Andre Agassi. Maybe just the look, maybe just the feel of that era. I don't know.
Sure.
That's my first
Well, I
thing.
mean, yeah. No. Well, it's the, yeah, that, because you were probably, that was in the 90s. So that's your childhood, right?
Yeah. And I would
And he
say
was probably
between,
the
well, it was
first
between
big
him, Sampras, and who's the
Sampras.
other one? There's like one more I'm forgetting, I feel like. There was Agassi, there was Sampras. I guess Nadal wasn't there just yet, right?
No, it would have
No, that.
been. I mean, would that be like Boris Becker, or is that after Becker?
I forgot
Yeah,
about
I don't
Boris
know my tennis timeline
Becker.
that well. Stefan Edberg?
That sounds about right.
It could
Well,
be.
the only reason I bring it up is because today's subject for episode 6, season 1, is a player who I actually only knew a little bit about. So for me, this is one of those rare examples where I taught myself a lot of information about Arthur Ashe today. So let's get
Yeah.
into it. Episode 6, season 1, we look back at the 1975 Wimbledon's Men's Open between Arthur Ashe and Jimmy Connors. Yeah, it's for folks who were wondering how I was going to force professional wrestling into this conversation this week. I'm going to get it out of the way right now. So if you've never been to Flushing, Queens, or for folks who've never been to Flushing, Queens, the home of the U.S. Open is Arthur Ashe Stadium, named for the subject of our discussion today, Arthur Ashe. It is an absolutely beautiful and stunning building. It's one of the nicest sports arenas you could ever go to, especially in New York. It's a really beautiful, really well-designed building.
Really?
And it's sort of found a second life outside of tennis as a venue for professional wrestling as well as tennis. And I only know this because I've seen a couple shows at Arthur Ashe taking place there. So,
Really?
yeah, it's a really interesting visual to see wrestling in that arena. It's just very beautiful for whatever reason.
Yeah, I bet that would be pretty incredible.
It's Wednesday night, and you know what that means. We're live in New York City. 20,177 AEW fans are here. I'm here along with Excalibur, Tony Schiavone.
Randall, I got to ask you because we're looking at 1975, and I don't mean to out you. How old were you in 1975?
Well, what this was the summer of 75.
Summer of 75.
So I was 2 going on 3.
Okay,
So I would have been 2 years
very
old.
young. Well, because as I mentioned, 86, I'm not born for another 11 years. So all of my interest in Arthur Ashe and his story is mostly late era as a historian, as a sports historian. Was Arthur Ashe an athlete that you were aware of when you were young in your 10, 9, 11
No.
year? No.
No, because as the story that we'll tell today kind of explains, no, he, I remember Jimmy Connors, John McEnroe, that would have been, but I don't remember ever seeing Arthur Ashe play as a child. I've seen him, clips since, but no, he was not a tennis player that I was aware of.
And I might as well get this out of the way now because we're really going to focus on the 1976 Wimbledon's men's final. But I am a historian as a profession. That's part of my job. So I do have to have this discussion very quickly. This story is hard to parse from mm-hmm. the racial connections to it. You got to understand, folks, that Arthur Ashe was the mm-hmm. first yes. black man to ever compete in a mixed tennis tournament. And unlike a lot of athletes who don't want to get involved in the politics or the racial aspects of their sport, Arthur Ashe was very aware of what it meant to people that he was competing. He understood the pressures of being the first black man to do this. His coach told him, "You can't screw this up, because if you do, we might not ever see another black tennis player at the U.S. Open." That was the real feeling in 1968.
Yeah, it's crazy.
And of course, Arthur Ashe Stadium is named for Arthur Ashe because he was the first American to win the U.S. Open in 1968, first black man to win the U.S. Open, still the only black man to win the U.S. Open as of today.
Wow.
And in 1968, directly after winning this U.S. Open, he's the first professional athlete. I can't believe we didn't talk about this in the episode. First professional athlete to ever go on the television show Meet the Nation. So a 25-year-old black man Wait. In 1968, the first professional athlete to be brought on television to talk about this. And I'm going to insert some clip right here because his intelligence is so jarring to hear him speak.
Yeah, class and grace.
Holding forth on questions of education and race, and he was very poised.
If you happen to be black in these times, maybe not 50, 30 years ago, but in these times, 1968, it's really a mandate that you do something. You must. And there are other athletes and other black leaders, period, who are using their positions of power and influence to...
Yeah, he handled himself in a way that you don't see a lot of professional athletes handle themselves today. Just so classy, so smart. And I was excited to learn about this story. Yeah, that's really my big intro. Randall, do you watch tennis these days? Are you a tennis guy today?
I'm going to say not really. I enjoyed tennis in the 90s quite a bit.
Yeah.
And that would have been probably the heyday of my tennis watching, viewing.
That sounds right.
With you know, I found it was compelling on both sides, men's and women's.
Mm-hmm.
But I also had a lot of free time in the 90s.
Yeah, that's true.
Kid. But now it's not. When Wimbledon or the French Open is on,
yeah,
mm-hmm. I'll tune in because I find it interesting to watch it on clay or to watch it on grass. I've always found those more interesting than, say, the U.S. Open, which is hard court. I don't know why.
No, that's a really good point, because I think one of the things that's interesting about tennis is that it's not the same depending on where you go. Like, golf is golf. You play golf. Maybe the locations, of course, are different, but it's still sand. It's still water. It's still grass.
Sure.
You almost have to change your entire game to play on clay as opposed to – it's a real difference, and it's always fascinating who excels at what portion of
this. Right, right. It seems like the modern players are really good on every surface now, right?
Yeah.
They're very competitive on every surface. But back in the day, I remember some dominating like Wimbledon, but not doing well in France, right? Because of the clay and the grass.
I want to say Nadal was the guy who was considered like the clay only guy. He's like the best on clay, but pretty good everywhere else. But on clay, you can't stop this man. Yeah. He's too good.
Yeah. Yeah.
So before we get into our last thing today, I just want to say, I want to shout out really quickly, Paul McCann and a lot of my friends over at Carmine's, because those dudes who lived in Queens and were working in New York City, they were the folks who really got me into tennis, mostly because it was like, wait, you guys are actively into this and watching it. It's not, you're not like being sarcastic. Like, you're really into this.
Right, right.
Living in Queens, living in New York City really does affect your tennis watching, because that U.S. Open facility is so close to almost everything.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right, because I know some of those same people as you well know.
Yeah, shout out.
And yeah, I was kind of shocked at that's their experience was so, they were really, really into it. And, you know, that's one of my regrets living in New York for the time that I did. I never got out there. So that's one of the regrets of not getting there.
I've still never gone to the Mets stadium to see a game. I've seen the stadium. I've seen Citi Field. I've heard it's beautiful to go watch a game in, but I've never actively watched a Mets game at Citi. I did actively watch one at Shea, and it's it was as bad as advertised. It was pretty terrible. It's pretty awful.
I saw one game at Shea. Yeah.
Oh God. All right. So before we get into our main story today, the 1975 Wimbledon's men's final, I'm bringing it back 2 weeks in a row. We're going to do a little bit of time warp. So if you were watching the Wimbledon's men's final on July 5th, 1975, you could have driven back to New York City and stopped in at one of the many fine movie cinema theaters to see the number one movie in America, maybe the most obvious one we've ever had, the 1975 American thriller Jaws, starring Peter, starring Robert Shaw, Roy Scheider, and Richard Dreyfuss.
Without change, without passion, and without logic, it lives to kill. A mindless eating machine. It will attack and devour anything. It is as if God created the devil and gave him Jaws.
Easily my favorite movie of all time. I don't have my Jaws mug that your wife gave me for Christmas with me, but I do take that to work every single day. And the kids assume that the picture of Richard Dreyfuss is me. They're like, do you have, is that a picture of you on the mug? I'm like, no, it is not.
It's not. I wish it was, but it's not.
You would have stopped.
You probably would have stopped several times at several different theaters to see that movie in 1975 on your way to the U.S. Open.
Jaws, I was going to ask you again. So 2 years old, 3 years old, was Jaws in your cultural purview within the next like couple of years, or was already out of cultural discussion?
No, Jaws was huge when I was a kid. Yeah. Obviously, I don't think I saw it when it first came out, but it was definitely a movie that affected all of us.
Well, it's also one of those eras where in the 70s, it wasn't uncommon for a popular movie to get re-released a couple years later in the theaters. Yeah. Like that was a pretty common thing in the 70s and 80s that really doesn't happen as much anymore.
Right, right. I do remember seeing Jaws 3D in the theater. I think that was the first Jaws I saw in the theater.
Oh my God. That's one of the worst movies I've ever seen.
But when you're a kid and whatever year that came out, it was pretty scary, pretty impressive.
Did you remember having the 3D glasses at the time? Were you wearing them?
Of course.
I like in those movies like that one and then Friday the 13th 3D, which came out not too far away from that. Whenever you have like a really obvious scene of 3D, they're like, I'm going to point this baseball bat right toward the camera. Like I would never do otherwise, but I'm going to do it right now. So on the way home from watching Jaws, you could have turned on the radio to listen to the number one song in America. That's right. Love. Love will keep us together. Written by Captain and Tennille.
Nice.
Maybe it's me personally. I've always preferred the Neil Sedaka version, but I gotta be honest, this is one of my least favorite songs of all time. I don't understand, like, this is from an era when, as a musician, as a guy who likes music, when I look at like the 1970s and songs like this, I'm like, man, it must have been so easy to be a musician in the 1970s compared to
but then there's some amazing music in the 70s, right?
Well, that was the other one. I was listening to the Steve Miller song, was it Take the Money and Run?
Okay.
And I was listening to the intro. I'm like, man, there's so much musicianship going on in this song that I kind of don't really like. But I'm like, man, it's crazy how much like guitar, like they're really talented, all these musicians. Then I look at like music today. I'm like, they have no talent at all. So, and finally, unless you have any extra thoughts on Captain and Tennille, was this?
No,
like,
I'll let that go.
And finally, you could go home and read the number one fiction book in America. This one's actually way more interesting than I thought at first. It's a book called The Money Changers by Arthur Haley, which is a fictional book about people in a bank, but it's technically about Bank of America in its earliest years of existence. Sort of tells the story of they essentially invent the automated teller machine before it's actually invented. So kind of a wild book that was also adapted into a 6.5-hour NBC miniseries in 1976, starring Kirk Douglas and Christopher Plummer.
Wow.
I know, I've never
The
heard
money takers, is that what it's called?
the money changers, the
The
money
money
changers, the
changers.
money changers. Yeah.
Okay.
Never heard of this one, but I was kind of fascinated by it. All right. That's it, folks. That's all the preamble I got. So, Randall, if you are ready, we will get into the bulk of episode 6 as we talk about Arthur Ashe and Jimmy Connors. So for folks who will pull behind the curtain, it took me 6 years of doing a different podcast and then a year of hiatus and then 4 episodes of this podcast before I finally was guilted into getting a better microphone. And I'm actually using my AirPods so I can actually hear out of the microphone headphones. This is like a big change
yes.
for me. I don't know. I hope this sounds good and I hope I don't have to go back and record it again. I hope it sounds.
No.
Hope it doesn't, and I also hope it doesn't sound too good, because if it does, then we have to go back and re-record everything else. That's a whole conversation.
Yeah.
But Randall, it's a pleasure to talk to you. How was your week? Everything good over there in the Midwest in Chi-Town?
Yeah, everything's good. It was, you know, it was a busy weekend, and all is well. Yeah.
Now, Randall, I got in an argument with somebody at work last week because they were talking about hockey, and I said that here in upstate New York, hockey is super popular. It's very popular. It's, I don't know if it's regional, especially in Utica with the Utica Comets and the and all the different teams around here.
Yeah,
Utica college hockey, big deal. And you also seem to like college hockey. You sort of grow up, you've been around this Midwest where hockey seems like a big deal. Do you feel like where you grow up affects what kind of sports you're into?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm curious as to what kind of an argument you were in. Was it regarding that topic?
My argument was that even though I'm in the minority, I've never liked hockey.
Move this man!
And I feel like an outsider. And then people asked me what my reasons were for not liking hockey. And I mostly was just joking. Like, I just sort of trolled everybody.
Okay.
I was like, it's a rich white man sport.
Sure.
Yeah. I just don't know. It never appealed to me. And I've always felt in the minority here in upstate New York because so many people love it.
Well, yeah, no, I agree. Growing up, I did not really watch hockey at all.
Mm-hmm.
I actually, my brother-in-law is from Minnesota, and he's the reason really why I kind of got into college hockey a little bit. And then, of course, the Blackhawks here in Chicago. But yeah, you're right. Growing up, the Blackhawks weren't on TV because the owner was lame. And you know, we didn't see them. You could hear them on the radio. It wasn't something my family was into. So it definitely matters where you grow up and kind of who you're with.
That's a great point. And the who you're with is a really interesting point, because over the years, you know, I'll put it this way. I love the New York Knicks.
Bing bong.
Tell me a little something, KD. Don't you regret not coming to the Knicks? Don't you regret not coming to the Knicks?
Let's go Knicks.
Currently, they're probably the team I am most singularly invested in right this moment.
You gotta be excited right now.
Yeah, on March 20th, 2023. When I was a kid, I liked the Knicks because my dad liked the Knicks. I would go to my godfather's house to watch like playoff games against the Heat. And then I stopped watching basketball for a while. And what dragged me back in was my buddies from the 2000s, early 2000s, post high school. We were watching Kobe and the Lakers. Sort of dragged me back into watching basketball. And then when I went to New York, Knicks all the time, going to games, it's everywhere. I just got back into it, right? Now, all this is preamble to discuss today's topic, which is tennis. Now, another sport, and I've learned over my time with this podcast so far, there are two things that I have been interested in this podcast. One, sharing the story of something I'm super interested in that no one really knows about. And number two is learning about something that I'm super interested in that I haven't known enough about. And today's topic falls into this standpoint. Today we're talking about tennis. We're talking about Arthur Ashe and Jimmy Connors on July 5th, 1975. Spoiler alert, Arthur Ashe is going to defeat Jimmy Connors to become the first African-American to win Wimbledon. It's a major story. And today we are going to look at Arthur Ashe. But another sport, and the reason I bring this whole thing up is, Randall, I hated tennis. I still don't
really
love I don't love tennis. I never grew up around it. What's your experience watching tennis or being around tennis growing up?
So, yeah, I watched tennis on TV. Mm-hmm. I remember when I was younger that I do remember Connors and McEnroe mm-hmm. at the end of their career.
It was the wrong side.
The ball chalk came up all over.
No, it was a bit of a spread, Mr. McEnroe. That was a good call.
Excuse me?
That was a bit of a spread.
Look, you can't be serious, man. You cannot be serious! That ball was on the line!
And I remember McEnroe's personality kind of dominated, right? Because he's...
Oh, yeah. He was a character.
Yeah, yeah. So was Connors. But I think just because McEnroe was younger, he was probably more prevalent when I was able to watch. McEnroe, and I also remember watching a lot of women's tennis.
Oh, yeah. Back in those days. Well, I don't know if we'll play this one exactly after we played the episode from last week where we talked about sports that don't seem to have any change between men's and women's sports. And I do believe that tennis has really dominated. Tennis and soccer, especially in America, it feels like there's no difference. You're watching. It doesn't matter whether you're watching men's or women.
Right, right. Yeah, exactly. The game is a little different in that, you know, there's more volleys. I think we've talked about that.
Yes.
On the women's side.
More serve heavy. And or more volley heavy with the women, more aces and serve heavy with the men. Yeah,
which I quite honestly, I think volley is more exciting to watch.
Way more exciting to watch.
So I mean, it's like this is way more fun to watch. But yeah, absolutely.
Well, let me tie into how I actually got interested in tennis. And the reason I have to shout out is Carmine's Restaurant, which you are familiar with. Carmine's in Times Square, New York, one of the great tourist restaurants in all of New York City. Carmine's in Times Square.
Carmine's, New York City's legendary family-style restaurant, specialize in traditional Southern Italian cuisine with signature abundant portions for every celebration for over 20 years. Celebrate at Carmine's for birthdays, rehearsal dinners, or corporate events. Or call our catering staff for your next party or meeting. Carmine specializes in parties of six or more, serving our delicious Scarpiello wings to penne alla vodka to veal salt and bocca, and famous Titanic dessert.
And for years, I worked there. You also worked there. My sister worked there. We have a long history with this restaurant. And shout out to a person who I did not think I was going to mention today. Shout out to my good friend, Paul McCann, who may or may not be working at Carmine's. Because for years, Paul McCann and all my friends who lived out in Queens, who lived near what is today Arthur Ashe Stadium, where the U.S. Open is held every year, are obsessed and have been obsessed with tennis because it's right there in their back door in Flushing, Queens. And it was that sort of excitement that these folks showed me over the years that really sort of opened up my mind to be like, oh, tennis, am I missing something? Have I been missing something all along? And that's really where I got into this story. And again, sort of ties into what you were saying. Sometimes it's not the location, it's you need that entrance way. You need someone to hold your hand and take you down the driveway.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you would have been about 3 years old when this event happened, presumably.
Yes. So I remember it like it was yesterday.
All right. Well, if that's the case, let's get into a little backstory. Today, we're mostly going to be focusing on Arthur Ashe, of course, the legendary tennis player, and specifically his matchup on July 5th, 1975, in the finals of the Wimbledon tournament against Jimmy Connors. So let's do a little bit of a backstory, and let's focus first on Jimmy Connors.
Playing at Wimbledon made me proud. You know, my first time I came over just to walk out onto the center court was what you dream about as a young player. But, you know, to have left something behind and been a big part of everything that's gone on there from, you know, from the day the championships first was played, you know, it's pretty special. There are not many that win Wimbledon. Only one a year can win.
Going into Wimbledon 1975, Jimmy Connors is the overwhelming favorite. He is the previous tour's winner. He is currently ranked number one in the world. And in 1974, he had gone 99-4.
Wow.
He was so dominant during this period of time that many of the people in the locker room just sort of talked about he was going to go on winning everything for years. My first thought would be early era Tiger Woods, right? Where it's like, oh my God, how good is this? He's never going to lose, right?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. That's what it seems like, because he was young at this point in his career, correct?
Considerably 10, I think 10 years younger than Arthur Ashe at this time. He is the young upstart in the world.
Right.
And people who were watching Wimbledon during the semifinals as he played a gentleman named Roscoe Tanner were having a hard time arguing this case. This is a quote from Richard Evans, who wrote about this in the Tennis Open. He was pumping and rolling like never before. Jimbo only just stopped short of beating his breast like a miniature tennis Tarzan. There's quite an image. But this sort of extravagant show of power in tennis looked to be part of the downfall, because not only was the world watching, there was another person who was very specifically watching in the back, and that, of course, is Arthur Ashe.
You, in general, what you want to do is a combination of two things. You must be able to control the middle, which is a theory I remember discussing, I fully believe, with Bill Russell one day, that in most sports, the team or the person that dominates the middle is going to win.
The middle of what?
Middle
of
period.
The court? Or?
The middle period. Like in a football game. Next time you watch a football game, if the...
Arthur Ashe, and we'll get into his backstory about where how he got here before that, but he had just finished a win in his own semifinal, and he's sitting in the Wimbledon locker room watching as Jimmy Connors is destroying Richard Tanner. Just Roscoe Tanner. And really... this is sort of one of my favorite parts about this story, is Ashe was so smart. It's one of the things that, and I'll throw some clips in because I heard some really beautiful audio during this period about what Ashe had to say. So elegant, so smart, so classy in sort of the way he carried himself. And there was this sort of feeling like he was aware that his style sort of played into Jimmy Connors' hand. And if he was going to beat Jimmy Connors, he was going to have to do something different. He was going to have to change his game.
How do you plan the strategy of how to defeat a Connors, let's say, just to pick a name out of the air?
That's a good name. I hope to get him to play for our Davis Cup team next year. I think there's a pretty good possibility he might play, although he hasn't given me an official okay yet. It depends upon the surface you're playing on. It depends upon the ball you're going to use. Mm-hmm. And it also, I think, depends upon where you're playing.
I just want to make this point because it's a little convoluted before we get to the actual match.
Sure.
There is a little bit of an issue, a contention between Arthur Ashe and Jimmy Connors already. Particularly because, and we'll get into a greater conversation and down the road here about this, Arthur Ashe, whether it's politics, race relations, just in general, he is one of the very first most prominent activists, you would call them, or a sporting figure who uses their position to make change. Ashe was already sort of frustrated with Connors because of the... Well, let me go here. 2 years before this event, Arthur Ashe was leading the attempt of the American tennis professionals' boycott of the Wimbledon tournament. So 2 years earlier, Ashe and many players in the American Tennis Association are boycotting Wimbledon as a labor uprising. They're trying to get better things for themselves.
Okay.
And this is where my history teacher is going to kick in. Jimmy Connors, during this time, is a decade younger than Ashe, and he is not involved in these things at all. He does not join the boycott. He is what you refer to in history as a free rider. Now, if you've never heard this terminology before, non-history people, free rider refers to a term for people who get benefits from a organization that they are not involved in. A really easy example of this is not every elderly person you know is a member of the AARP. But every time the AARP and the members make a change that benefits all elderly people, even if you are not in the AARP, you still benefit. You still get that benefit. Thus, you are a free rider, right?
Right.
So this is the thing that Arthur Ashe, it bothered him that, you know, that Jimmy Connors was going to benefit from the work that he and these older members of the ATP had done. And he was a free rider. And rather than join the boycott, Jimbo essentially leaped into the void and just sort of started playing and didn't care.
Right.
And this was really the time when he ascends to number one in the world. Becomes the first champion of the Open era who has no connection to amateur tennis from the days before. The first who wasn't you know, a territorial guy who had to take his talents around the country and show that he was barnstorming. The first guy of his era to really take advantage of the new style of how tennis players are getting paid and making money. And yet, he didn't seem to be very grateful. Instead, before Wimbledon, he and his manager, a guy named Bill Reardon, sued Arthur Ashe for comments that Ashe had made about Connor's recent Davis Cup boycott.
Yep.
Ashe, on his own quote, I love this line here. He goes, "Jimmy Connors, he ain't one of the boys," he said to Time magazine in 1975. "Right now, he is sorely misguided. We hardly say hello. Is this what the ATP has fought for? Many yearn for Ashe, the sentimental favorite, 32 years old, to give Jimmy Connors his comeuppance at Wimbledon, and thus the background is here."
Yeah, and, you know, we can understand how Arthur Ashe could feel this way, but at the same time, let's take a step back and look at Jimmy Connors. He's like 22, 23 years old at this point.
Yeah.
And all he wants to do is play tennis. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And he's like, wait a minute. You want me to boycott something that I just want to go play? I want to go win. And, you know, I think it's difficult probably for someone of that age to really grasp the enormity of what's really happening there.
Oh,
right?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I work.
I'm not defending him, but at the same time, you're like, well, he just wants to play tennis.
That makes total sense because look, I am in my late 30s and I now work in a profession that is very pro-union, one of the most strong unions around the entire country. And only in the last 5 to 10 years have I been more invested and paid more attention in unions. As a history teacher, I understand some of the benefits and I'm also aware of potential downfalls, but I didn't care about those things at 20, 21. I just didn't care. Yeah. Right. And I can't imagine that I would have cared anymore if I was a professional athlete as opposed to a non-professional musician rolling around Brooklyn. Right.
Absolutely.
When you're making this kind of money and you're this talented, a lot of times you can't be bothered or you choose not to be bothered.
Yeah,
as a guy like Arthur Ashe, who experienced a different lifestyle.
Absolutely.
His view is different.
But now it was Ashe, the civil rights activist and public intellectual, who more and more galvanized the public's attention and fully took over when heart disease and quadruple bypass surgery forced him to retire at age 36. He was active in the fight against apartheid in South Africa.
Like this, look, watch.
And in this country, worked to bring better athletic facilities to black youth and protested on behalf of Haitian immigrants trying to enter the U.S.
Before we get into this match, let's do just a little bit of backer up here. Arthur Ashe essentially first learned tennis in 1947, about a year after his mother's death. He picked up a racket at the age of 7 at a park not far from his house. He sort of stuck around playing the game, eventually catching the attention of a guy named Dr. Robert Waller, a tennis coach from Lynchburg, Virginia, who was active in the black tennis community. Under Robert Johnson's direction, Ashe excelled in his first tournament, reaching the junior national championships. He would move to St. Louis. He worked through the junior national titles in 1960, again in 61. He was ranked the 5th best junior player in the country by the end of his time. He went to the University of California, Los Angeles, UCLA, and got a degree in business administration. So he went through the college route again, touring, sort of showing off his skills, the amateur levels. Jimmy Connors, on the other hand, he's really the professional player who was one of the best players in the early 70s and early 80s. Just an intense, aggressive style of player, a different type of player, young, hungry, right? During his career, he would go on to win 109 singles championship and was ranked number one in the world.
Yeah.
160 consecutive weeks. At the time of our game and our match today, he is 22 years
old.
He is number one player in all of the world, and he is the defending Wimbledon champion.
Right.
This is so fast. I'm trying to think of other great old guy versus young guy matchups. I wish I had looked this up before. Beforehand, where like the old guy versus young guy, but there is something about it. Like, and it's funny because, right, when I was 10 years younger, I would have been rooting for Jimmy Connors. Now I'm all absolutely rooting for Arthur Ashe. I want to go
right? You get him.
All right. So I guess we might as well, I guess I'll spoil it a little bit here. So here's the match and the game, 1975 Wimbledon men's final. I mean, we know what's going to happen here. Arthur Ashe is going to defeat Jimmy Connors in four sets. But let's understand how we got here, right? These two had played each other four times previously, and Connors had won all four matches. Many folks expected this to be the continuance. But as we mentioned, Arthur Ashe was very invested in what Jimmy Connors is doing against Roscoe Tanner in the semifinals. He and his agent, U.S. Davis Cup captain Donald Dell, are watching this match. And essentially, they decide to use a plan that had just recently been successful with Muhammad Ali taking back the title from George Foreman, the idea of rope-a-dope.
Now, no matter how much he hits you, you don't do nothing, okay? You don't want to get drawn into a boxing match here.
Man, that tramp's got the energy of a hobo.
Yeah, he never stops punching, except to check out his bindle.
Randall, are you familiar with rope-a-dope?
I am familiar with rope-a-dope.
For folks who are not...
Yeah, I don't know that I've ever seen it used in this context with a tennis match, but I'm loving it.
No, I like the idea of it from other sports. I've always saw this as a boxing thing. I'm a big boxing guy. Essentially, the idea of rope-a-dope in boxing is to allow the more aggressive fighter to tire themselves out, to punch themselves out.
Okay, Homer, he's tired. He's tired. Now's your chance. Nudge him. Nudge him.
Now, famously, this would lead to Muhammad Ali having lots of health problems later on in his career from letting George Foreman punch him multiple times. But he did win the title, so, you know. 6-1, half of the other. Ashe would implement his version, the tennis version of this strategy. Essentially, instead of giving Jimmy Connors that pace, that speed, his idea was to slow it down, slow it way down, right? This dink and dunk, slicing, cracking the flat serve, you know, really forcing Connors into a game that he did not want to play.
Yeah, which is... As I recall, and what and this is not Arthur Ashe's typical game. He's kind of a power player like Jimmy Connors, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, so, this is
we hear this all the time. You should play to your strengths, right, and not to their weaknesses. Well, he's playing to his weakness, but Arthur Ashe, this is also his weakness, but he has to overcome it because. You know what I'm saying? This wasn't natural for him to do.
No, I love it. I think this is fascinating. And because what really gets me about this is you have to be self-aware. Yeah. You've got to go through years of winning and losing and exactly. and having a real understanding about what you can do and what you can't. And that takes a lot. Like a young man like Jimmy Connors is not going to look at Arthur Ashe and say, I'm going to change my game at all. Come beat me. Right. And that's really, that's old man stuff. All I think of is like old men playing pickup basketball. And you're like, how does this guy have 15 rebounds and 20 points and he hasn't moved around at all? I don't understand it. It's technique. It's veteran savvy. Yeah. I don't know what you would call it. This match itself is a classic encounter. It lasts four sets. Ashe would start strong, winning the first set 6-1. Connors would come back, winning the second set 6-1. The third set, the most closely contested, had both players really dominating and displaying their skill. This is probably, if you're going to watch this matchup, this third set is really where the action is. This is the heart of the matchup. It is Ashe who comes out on top, winning 7-5.
30-40.
So, set point for Connors.
The fourth set was a tense affair. Both players are going at it for every point. Connors had several opportunities to break Ashe's serve, but was unable to do so. Finally, in the tiebreak, Ashe managed to outplay Connors, winning it 7-4 and sealing his victory. The old man did it. Score one for the old guys.
He did.
So, two championship points for Arthur Ashe.
That's it! And he's done it. He really has done it.
You know, when you picked this topic, I didn't know much about it. So, I obviously looked into it. And I watched, I don't know if you watched, I saw on YouTube an interview with Arthur Ashe on the Dick Cavett Show. Did you happen
awesome.
To see that?
Yeah. I'm going to use some audio for that for sure.
Excellent. Because, you know, he described that this was at post-match, right? He had already won. Mm-hmm. And I watched that interview and he described what he was doing. Right. And Arthur Ashe is a very cerebral guy, right?
Smart,
he was a really intelligent person. He talked a lot about how, you know, the balls are different in each tournament, how the weather,
rackets.
You know, the weather was set up perfect for him and whether you're right-handed, left-handed, all this stuff. And then he described how he played that match. Then I went and watched like a condensed version of this match.
Yeah.
And it was exactly as he said.
If the center and the two and the left and the right guard can do their job, you're going to win. Uh-huh. You're going to move the ball. Same with basketball. The center dominates.
Mm-hmm.
Same with soccer.
Dominate the middle.
Dominate. If you can control the middle, you got a good chance. Yeah. If you can't, you got problems.
How would I do it here with only one other person here? I'd have to...
Put this mic in the middle. Maybe.
And that takes so much self-control for an athlete to play a different style than you're used to playing. It's
and to commit
unbelievable.
To it.
Yeah.
And that's,
oh,
what
yeah.
And that's what drives me nuts because I always think about this. One of my biggest problems over the years with watching tennis can last for like 7 hours. It's insane how long it is. Not only to commit to this for one set, but to be able to change your entire game for multiple hours. That's a huge physical change for a
absolutely.
Guy who,
absolutely.
You know, I don't know what the age cutoff for tennis is, but I can't imagine it's that much older than your mid to late 30s. I don't know that you're
right.
playing tennis in your early 40s.
No,
and we'll get to why
not.
He didn't. Yeah, we'll get to why he didn't, certainly.
Well, yeah, right.
So let's talk about some of the major impacts here. One, we have to talk about the societal impact. Ashe had won major events before, including mm-hmm. the first U.S. Open back in 1968. But to win this title on center court, much like his fellow pioneer Althea Gibson, who 20 years earlier had won first for women, he became the first African-American man to win Wimbledon. With this win over the seemingly then invincible Connors, this sort of offered hope to fellow players. It showed that thought and courage do matter in tennis. It's not just skill. Anyone can be beaten, right? I just keep thinking about Rocky. He's not a machine. He's a man, right? That's all I keep thinking of myself. Like anyone can. So it's obviously significant in sports, in both in terms of breaking down racial barriers and sort of elevating the general profile of tennis across the world. Showed that Black players could compete at the highest levels of tennis and, of course, inspired a new generation of young athletes because Arthur Ashe was very cool and very hip at the time, right?
Yep.
Beyond tennis, this is also a victory for the broader sort of cultural and social significance. This is a time when racial tensions are still pretty high. You know, civil rights movement, 1965, late 60s
right.
and early 70s, not that far away. This is sort of seen by a lot of people, whether you are just supporters or African-Americans. This is a symbol of this ongoing struggle and this symbol of hope and progress. And it really is a beautiful moment. And I just want to stop here really quickly because we can get into a greater discussion at the end. But one of the things that drives me crazy is this terminology in the world we live in, this term, stick to sports.
Sure.
As if an athlete is only available to discuss sports only. They have no other parts of their life. Would you ever say this to any other person? Like if someone walked up to you and was like, hey, stick to sales, would you?
Right?
That's an insane thing to say. Like you're a human being.
It is ridiculous, right? It's absolutely absurd.
And I guess,
it's athletes, it's entertainers.
Entertainers,
you know, they're told to stick to, you know, acting or whatever. Yeah, it's but they're in the spotlight, right? They have a platform.
Well, and that's the thing, right? Like I know that people are like, oh, they're abusing their platform, yada yada yada. I go the other way. I believe that if you have worked hard enough in your life,
sure,
that you should be able to utilize your platform for things that you believe in and care desperately about. That's one of the benefits of being able to work your way up into a position of cultural relevance where people want to listen to what you have to say, right?
Absolutely.
Like there are people who care about what athletes and entertainers say because they've worked their way to the top of whatever their chosen profession is. It does matter.
Right.
You've built that space for yourself to talk.
Well, the whole concept of our country is, you know, we all have a voice, we all have a vote. So one's, you know, we all have that right.
Yeah. And not for nothing, I never hear people say stick to sports when it's an athlete whose politics they like, right? I haven't heard anyone tell.
No, absolutely. Yeah,
that's like a very modern issue. All right, let's get into sort of the aftermath here, because I do want to have a quick conversation with a few other things here at the end before we close up. So Jimmy Connors, for his part, would go on to win the U.S. singles title in 1976 and 1978, specifically against Bjorn Borg. He would win in 1982, 1983. He was also won the World Indoor Championship five times. He won Wimbledon and the U.S. doubles multiple times. He's a member of the Davis Cup team multiple times. So regardless of what happened to Jimmy Connors here in this particular match, he's doing fine.
He did just fine.
Now we need to get into the sad part of the story. In 1979, Arthur Ashe suffered a heart attack while holding a tennis clinic in New York. He was hospitalized and later underwent quadruple bypass surgery. This would continue, and in the 1980s, he would decide to retire from tennis. His final career record of 818 wins, 260 losses, and 51 titles easily put him in the Tennis Hall of Fame.
And now Arthur Ashe. Arthur took the inaugural U.S. Open title in 1968, Australia in 1970, Wimbledon in 1975, and the French and Australian doubles in 1970 and 77. He was a 10-year member of the United States Davis Cup team, and in 1980 became its captain. Today, he is involved in a number of tennis programs for junior and underprivileged players. Here with Arthur today.
Yeah, in 1983, Arthur Ashe would have a second bypass surgery. After this operation, in order to accelerate his recovery, he would receive a blood transfusion. Many people look to this moment, this blood transfusion, as the moment that he would contract human immunodeficiency virus, or HIV. He would continue feeling numbness in his right arm. He was hospitalized again in 1988. Test shows that he had a bacterial infection called toxoplasmosis, which is most often present in people who have HIV. It was later revealed that he had both HIV and AIDS. This information was kept private from the public, which I think is super fascinating, especially today when it's so hard to keep anything hidden from the public.
Well, I think in that era, especially with HIV and AIDS, that was fairly common.
Yes.
Right?
Because the narrative around it wasn't, we were still confused by the narrative. Exactly. There was all this fear.
Yes. Absolutely.
I mean, him and Magic Johnson, probably the two biggest sports symbols to have this issue, right? Those were the two I remember hearing.
Those are the two that I can remember.
Yeah.
Sports symbols for sure.
But I also want to point out somebody more recent. I want to point out Chadwick Boseman, the actor, who also suffered over the last few years before his death with an illness that he chose to hide from the general public. It was genuinely shocking when it was found out that he had died and had this illness. And again, Arthur Ashe presumably wanted to keep this on his own time or tell this story on his own time. Unfortunately, this was taken away from him in 1992. USA Today newspaper contacted him about reports of his illness, which had up until this point been private. Instead of being bullied by the USA Today, Arthur would decide to preempt the story and go public on his own terms. He would hold a press conference with his wife on April 8th.
Or more specifically, just what are the parameters of personal privacy? What are they? Who sets them? And by whose authority are they issued? To me or to any other American, what is sacrosanct and or inviolable? It is, I believe, an important issue because the technical capability to know much of one's personal life, your life, credit cards.
This incited a whirlwind of attention. Right. And Arthur used this to raise awareness about AIDS and its victims. I love this quote from him from his memoir, Days of Grace. "I do not like being the personification of a problem, much less a problem involving a killer disease. But I know that I must seize these opportunities to spread the word. I go back to having a platform. It's important if you have this platform to speak out on things like this, especially at this time." He would go on to found Arthur Ashe Foundation for the Defeat of AIDS. He would speak before the UN General Assembly on World AIDS Day. He became a major figure outside of sports as well. I don't know that we're going to get to it here in our conversation, but there's probably a whole other bit about Arthur Ashe's involvement with Nelson Mandela and trying to end apartheid in South Africa. That's an entirely different conversation for his work with both trying to stop the spread of AIDS globally, of awareness for AIDS. He would be named 1992's Sports Illustrated Sports Person of the Year. Hold on to that thought for later. On February 6th,
yes.
On February 6th, 1993, sadly, Arthur Ashe would pass away from AIDS-related pneumonia in New York City at the age of 49. He was the second person ever, or the first person. His body was laid at the governor's mansion in his hometown in Richmond, Virginia, and he became the first person to lay in state at the monument since Confederate General Stonewall Jackson in 1863. So Stonewall Jackson, Arthur Ashe.
Arthur Ashe.
Interesting two guys. More than 5,000 people would line up to walk past the casket. He also had a funeral in New York City, attended by various figures of New York City at the time, Mayor Dinkins, Governor Douglas Wilder, Ron Brown, Rainbow Coalition's Jesse Jackson, Andrew Young, lots of folks there. It was a big deal.
Yeah.
The world had become familiar with Arthur Ashe's indomitable spirit. More from Julian Phillips.
Arthur was so special. Because of his quiet courage and selflessness, which made a lasting impact on those he touched.
His last gesture to me earlier that day, as he underwent more procedures, was simply like this.
On what would have been his 53rd birthday, on July 10th, 1993, a statue of him was dedicated on Richmond's Monument Avenue. Before this, that statue, Monument Ave, had mostly commemorated Confederate war heroes. As a fact, when Arthur was a child, he would not have been able to visit this because he was a black man. Arthur was depicted carrying books in one hand and a tennis racket in the other, symbolizing his love and knowledge in tennis. In 1997, the U.S. Tennis Association announced the new center stadium at the National Tennis Center would be named Arthur Ashe Stadium, commemorating the life of the first U.S. men's champion in the place where the U.S. all future U.S. U.S. Open championships will be determined. It's a beautiful stadium. If you've never seen it before in Flushing, Queens, it is stunning. It is an absolutely beautiful facility. Yeah, it's beautiful. It's really, really, really nice. And sadly, that is where the story of Arthur Ashe ends for now. Of course, his legacy sort of lives on. And again, you know, it's someone that I had no real connection to. I didn't like tennis. I didn't really know anything about tennis. And by the time I got into tennis, you know, we were talking about this before the pod. We don't tend to think about tennis the same way we think about other sports. Like, we think sometimes that Jordan is still the greatest NBA player of all time. Doesn't matter who came afterwards. But we tend to move on with tennis. Like, when we were growing up, we were always like, yeah, it's Agassi and Sampras and Rafael Nadal. Those guys are the best ever, right? We didn't think about Jimmy Connors.
No. And that's one of the things that I learned from this story is Jimmy Connors is still widely considered one of the greatest men's tennis players that ever lived.
Yeah, who knew?
He's still the winningest tennis player, men's tennis player of all time. I didn't realize that he was regarded that highly.
No.
Because you're right. Tennis seemed to move on in the 90s. And then now with Federer and Nadal and and what's the other guy? I'm gonna
Pete Sampras, Andy Murray. There's a couple different guys.
The one that's really good now.
Djokovic.
Yes.
Yeah, he's a crazy person, but man, he's
I was getting
tennis.
Him confused with the Jokic in the NBA because they're both Joker.
I would love to see Djokovic and Jokic hanging out. That would be a great time. But, I'd totally be here for it.
Right? But those three right now have been dominating, right? For years.
Well, also, too, I think we also grew up in the era and watched tennis in the era of the Williams sisters. And I think that once, like, Venus and Serena showed
That's
up,
the other thing.
Tennis kind of, like, took a different path. Those it were the did. Two biggest stars in the world, right?
Well, and also, this Wimbledon final was two American tennis players.
Yeah.
And then while I was doing a little bit of reading and research, I looked up, when's the last time that's happened? On the men's side. And actually in the 90s, there were 8 years in the 90s where it was two men in the Wimbledon final, which I'm like, oh, okay. Yeah. I forgot, you know, that we had some really good tennis players for a while.
Yeah. I always think No, go ahead. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, but I mean, but since then, we're not affecting the tennis anymore. The American.
No. We've moved on. That's it's a different sport for different cultures. Now, I got to be honest. I feel like the first tennis player who really I even knew about, even casually, was probably Andre Agassi, who in reality was not quite as good as his celebrity made him out to be. Like, sure. If you look at Agassi's numbers compared to like the guys who were around him, he's really not very good. He was just famous, right?
He was very famous.
Yeah, the Brooke Shields thing going on at the time. Exactly. It was a big deal.
He was doing commercials all the time. Yeah, he was huge.
So before we close up here today, and I just wanted to make a point. We had mentioned that in 1992, Arthur Ashe was awarded the Sports Illustrated Sports Person of the Year. Now, before I
deservedly up, so for him.
Deservedly so. And what I've noticed when I looked at some research on here is that this award fluctuates wildly between people who feel like obviously folks who deserved it and obviously mistakes. So when you were looking at this list, were there any obvious mistakes that stood out to you in hindsight? Boy, we really botched that one.
Well, I mean, I know you've got a few, I'm sure, but I was looking at it, I think it was Lance Armstrong.
Lance Armstrong was a tough one.
That's a mistake.
Okay. This whole conversation, we have a lot of time, will be about the details. Yes or no? Did you ever take banned substances to enhance your cycling performance?
Yes.
Yes or no? Was one of those banned substances EPO?
Yes.
Did you ever blood dope or use blood transfusions to enhance your cycling performance?
Yes.
Did you ever use any other...
Now, Pete Rose in 75 is an interesting one because he gets it for being the World Series MVP in 75. And I have always been on the side of saying, I think that Pete Rose got kind of a raw deal. I think he should be in the Hall of Fame. Just like, say that he gambled. But also, I'm sure they would like to take this one back.
For Bill Buckner, but he couldn't bend over to pick him up.
Man,
how about it?
Speaking of the World Series and the great tradition here in Boston with the Red Sox.
Well, they call it the curse of the Bambino. Right here. The city of losers.
Easy.
Kings, how about you help? It?
Did you prep Pete Rose?
Yeah. I also, you know, just looking at the list quickly, I see, you know, Brett Favre, probably not the best choice.
It says
for his perseverance and his passion.
Details now surrounding accusations that retired NFL quarterback Brett Favre used welfare funds to help build a new volleyball stadium at his alma mater, the University of Southern Mississippi, where his daughter played the sport. A former director of Mississippi's welfare agency, John Davis, has now pleaded guilty to federal and state charges that he conspired to misspend tens of millions of those welfare funds meant for the poorest families in what is the poorest state in the U.S.
So did he not win anything that year? I mean, I'd have to double check.
I'd have to look this up. We were trying to figure this out last night because I also noticed that everyone else on this list has like a legitimate reason next to it.
Right.
At least with Lance Armstrong, like we know he was a jerk but in 2002, it was his fourth. You know, we didn't know he had been
cheating. Four-time Tour de France winner, later disqualified.
Later disqualified, right? Exactly, right? But like the Favre one, I don't get it. Did he retire in 07 or did they think he was going to retire? I don't understand. The one that really sticks out in my craw when I look back at this just feels so obvious in hindsight is 1998 with Mark McGwire and Sammy Sosa. Yeah. I mean, as I get older, I sort of think to myself, there's no way that the media or Major League Baseball or somebody, we were all complicit. We all knew. Look at the size of Jeff Bagwell's head, for God's sakes. Like, we knew. We just wanted baseball to be better because it'd come back from the strike. We were just like, whatever. Whatever it takes.
Now, if you want to crown them, then crown their ass. But they are who we thought they were. And we let them off the hook.
Thanks,
Coach. You're absolutely right. But it is kind of ridiculous in hindsight. I mean, they did kind of bring baseball back from the strike and everything that year.
Oh, for sure.
But it was a little bit of, you know, false pretenses, right?
I just mean, like, look, I was in 98, I would have been 12, right? I don't know that I cared one way or the other about the steroids thing. I knew people were talking about it. But, like, today, when you look back at the story and you look back at the hindsight, like, man, it felt so obvious. Like, these guys were so big, dude, so big. All right, and that's really what I had from the Sports Illustrated list. It's a good list. If you ever want to look for an interesting sports conversation, do yourself a favor. Go to Wikipedia, look through the winners, and get a good laugh out of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Before I head out, I just want to say, Randall, I really enjoyed talking about this. But again, it really does make me wonder, would Arthur Ashe today be sort of in this sort of Colin Kaepernick zone where he is beloved by a huge group of people but also hated by a huge group of people because of his activism? Or was that the case back in the 1970s and it just wasn't as public? Because we got about a minute left. So.
That's a great question. I have no idea what it was like back then. And, I don't know, because he probably would have remained active in activism.
Oh, right? For sure. Absolutely. If you're still alive.
But, you know, Muhammad Ali was an activist as well.
And we also remember he was not quite as popular back then as he is today.
Back then, but he was much more popular in his later years before he passed. Yeah. Don't you think? I mean,
oh, for sure. Oh yeah, Arthur Ashe. I really enjoyed learning about that story. I went to look up and I was trying to figure out what the next upcoming tennis event is. The next US Open isn't until June 15th. So we're actually not too far away from the next US Open, which is June 15th through June 18th of this year. Maybe now I'll have to drive back down to New York and go see it. Are we going to be on vacation? We won't be on vacation together.
No. That's July.
That's July. I knew that.
We're on vacation in July.
As you can tell, I need to be reminded multiple times of things. I don't actually have a ton of topical sports stuff this week because I have something coming up this week that I wanted to share with you. But I do have two quick things. Number one, I know we always talk about soccer on here. The Champions League final is set for 3 weeks from yesterday. It will be the mighty Manchester City versus the surprising upstart Italians Inter Milan. Randall, I have to ask you, I'm kind of torn here. I certainly don't like Manchester City and all of their oil money, and I certainly don't want to see them win, but they're clearly the best soccer team in the world and should probably win, right? I'm kind of torn between these two thoughts.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, they're a state-run organization at this point, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, they are clearly the best soccer team in the world.
I watched a couple minutes of that. Or I watched the first 30 minutes of the Manchester City Real Madrid semifinal game yesterday before I was leaving the gym, and oh my god, it wasn't even close. Yeah. They ran all over the pitch. I've never seen Real Madrid get beaten like that. It was wild. And even, you know, even though I hate Manchester City, I am a little bit, I don't want to say I'm rooting for them, because I'm certainly not, but I do think that Pep has earned this. I think he deserves it after all this time. I think he's the best in the world.
He is a great football coach, without a doubt. Yeah, no doubt about it.
It does feel sort of unfair that they have Erling Haaland, the 22-year-old baby Thor, on this team, just scoring 40 goals a year. It's insane. I've never seen anything like
it. It is insane. You're like, really? Yeah, I know. It's they just keep adding and adding, and you know, there's no end in sight.
We are down to four teams left in the NBA finals tournament.
Right.
We are down to the Denver Nuggets taking on the Los Angeles Lakers and the Boston Celtics taking on the Miami Heat.
Yeah.
Again, feels like we're heading toward Boston, Los Angeles, even though both teams are down 1-0. Would you rather watch a redo of a Boston, Los Angeles classic rivalry, or are you here to watch Miami, Denver, some new talent?
You know, the Boston LA series would be very compelling. That's a loaded question, because you know, I don't want to see LA in the finals, but
certainly.
But I would absolutely watch LA Boston. But I would like to see the Nuggets finally get over the hump and into the NBA finals, get out of the Western Conference.
Yeah.
And you know what Jimmy Butler is doing this postseason is incredible.
I think that over the course of the last like month and a half, I've finally convinced myself because I've started watching enough games.
Yeah.
Jokic might be the best player, one of the best players I've watched in the last 10 years. He is outstanding. He's way better than I even I was giving him credit for. Like
absolutely.
He's such a game changer that, again, much like Pep and City, maybe he deserves it. Maybe he just does deserve it because he's that good.
Right. And it's with him, it looks so effortless, right? Yeah. It's like
to watch a big man do those weird back passes. Crazy.
Yeah, it's almost like watching an adult play with a bunch of kids sometimes because he's just, it just seems so simple. but, you know, we'll see. I think it's still a series for sure. Even though the Lakers lost, they you know, the first game, they made it interesting in the second half.
So it's funny you say that because I'm kind of unsure what to take away from that game. Because part of me thinks, okay, you needed the biggest game of his career from Jokic to save the Nuggets from blowing a 20-point lead. That's a bad sign.
Right.
But also, Davis had a massive game. The Lakers shot really well. Even LeBron, who I has gotten to the end of the game, I'm like, well, he's kind of having a bad game. Then I went to look at the stats. I'm like, he's not really having a bad game.
No,
it's just
a
normal game. All those things happened. And they almost made it back. They kind of felt like they should have won. It felt like it was the comeback was there. So I'm kind of torn about how I feel at the end of that one game.
Yeah, I think it's all about adjustments, right? I mean,
for sure. Yeah.
So we'll see what happens in game two and who adjusts better. And then, of course, I was watching last night was the Boston game, right?
Yep.
And at the end of the first half, I'm like, this Boston team looks unbelievable.
yeah right?
And then I kind of tuned it out. I was doing some of the things. It was on TV. I wasn't really paying attention. And then I look at the fourth quarter. I'm like, what's going on? How is Miami winning? And then Miami held on and won that. Well, they more than hung on. They won it.
Well, it's like I said last week, Miami just seems to want it more than everybody else. They just seem to try harder. And this is where I guess I got to tie in the part I was going to get into. I am very much hoping that Miami dominates the Celtics because on Thursday next week, I have to take my seniors on their senior trip to Boston. So I will be in Boston all day on Thursday. So I will try my best to look around for sad Celtics fans and sad Red Sox fans because both their teams are terrible and sad Bruins fans because they blew it. And if I see one Mac Jones jersey, I'll try and take a picture and send it to you. I don't believe that I will anywhere. And I guess my question is, you're a well-traveled man. It's been many years since I've been to Boston. Have you been to Boston anytime recently?
The last time we were in Boston was 2019.
So is there any food, anything I should be going to get while I'm out in Quincy Market doing the whole Boston thing?
Oh, well, you know, we were with kids, so it was very touristy.
Yes.
No, I honestly, I don't have any. I mean, you got to just get some seafood. That's pretty much.
Yeah.
That's my suggestion. Just get
my
seafood.
My friend at work, Audrey, told me to get a lobster roll. There's like a place. It's like one of the oldest like bars in the city that you can get the lobster roll from. That's what I'm aiming at right now.
Yes.
I am excited about it, but it's, again, this is a senior trip for seniors, and because, you know, this is the end of the year, and we only have so much money as a school, we have essentially removed, by popular demand, any educational aspect of this trip, so it's mostly just a chill trip. Like, I'm not gonna, I was like, kids, you don't have to learn anything from me. I don't have to teach. I mean, I'll still throw them old man teacher facts, because I am me, and I have no choice but to. But yeah, we're doing, like, the Boston Aquarium, and then we're just
going to
the Quincy Market. Yep. And then we're taking them on the Spirit of Boston, which is a boat that has like a DJ and a catering thing. So you can look at the skyline and dance and eat. So it'll be a good time. I'm excited for it. it might throw off my editing schedule next week, and we could talk about that off the air, but I just wanted to bring that up to our folks. So, folks, by the time you hear this on Saturday, if you have any suggestions for places that I should go in Quincy Market or food or restaurants or anything in Boston you know of, send them to your boy. Hit me up on Twitter, Instagram. Send me some info, because I'm going to need it for next week. Randall, that's really all I got for today, unless you have anything else that's on your mind. Then otherwise, we can start thinking about next week.
Yeah, no, it sounds good. I today's episode with Arthur Ashe, you touched on how you learned a lot. I learned a lot, not only about Arthur Ashe, but about Jimmy Connors.
Yeah.
Because he was an integral part of this story.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was, I enjoyed that quite a bit. But no, I don't have anything else.
All right, wonderful. Well, if that's the case, folks, we episode 7 coming up next week, I want to say. And
yeah,
yes. Yeah, so I think we're going to do Catherine Switzer next week, and then we're rolling on right toward the end of season 1, and also rolling on toward vacation, so I'm excited for all of that. Randall, enjoy the rest of your day, and I will talk to you soon.
Sounds good.